the success is making certain that you're prepared and you're investing in the technologies and the tools and being realistic about what you can expect, not putting too much supply out there that exceeds your ability to serve.
You're listening to the Elevate Podcast, and I'm your host, Robert Glazer. Join me as I talk to world-class performers about how they build their capacity and reach greater heights in leadership, business, and life, and how you can do the same. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. Our quote for today is from Tom Peters. Management is about arranging and telling. Leadership is about nurturing and enhancing. My guest today, Ed Bastian, is one of the most accomplished leaders in the world today. He's the CEO of Delta Airlines, a role he has held since 2016, and he's been a leader at the company for over 25 years. During Ed's tenure as CEO, Delta has become the world's most awarded airline, including being named the top-ranked airline by Wall Street Journal, Fortune, and many other publications. Ed was also recently named Chief Executive Magazine's 2023 Chief Executive of the Year. Ed, welcome. It's great to have you on the Elevate Podcast.
Well, Robert, good to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, I always think it's helpful to look back at the guest's early years. I know you've described yourself in an interview as a people geek. Do you have any particular stories from your upbringing where you developed passion and fascination with people? And I guess with leading people more specifically.
Probably. I grew up as one of a large family, one of nine kids in upstate New York. And my dad was a dentist, and he actually had his practice right in our home. And my mom worked for him as a hygienist.
Family business.
Yeah, exactly. And my grandmother lived with us, and it wasn't that big a house. So we were surrounded by people, morning, noon, and night. I was certainly, my brothers and sisters, and I was the oldest in the family.
I was just going to ask what number you were. So, yeah.
So I probably learned some survival skills and instincts from that experience. But more importantly, my parents did just a great job of setting a standard for us all and the responsibility that the oldest had to make sure, you know, you're where the bar gets set, and you know, your younger siblings continue to follow in your footsteps. And fortunately, we all did. But I've always been around people. I always get energy from folks. I love to be with groups, and I love to be part of experiences.
As you think back to that early kind of career or even childhood, were there any leaders who particularly influenced you who kind of informed your own leadership style?
You know, I read a lot when I was a young professional. I started my career at Pricewaterhouse in New York. I was an accountant, learned a lot from them. I went to Pricewaterhouse because I think they had the best roster of companies that were their clients. They offered me the lease. I got offered by a number of the accounting firms. They offered me the lease, but I thought they had the most value to offer me in turn. And so I'd be attracted to companies that I had as clients and leaders within the firm, but I also read a lot. It was a time when there was a lot of change in the world happening, and I was always fascinated by how to lead large organizations through success. And it's not that I ever dreamed I'd be a CEO someday. I just thought the management of change and leadership was an interesting science.
Was Herb Kelleher someone who came across your radar sort of even before you were at Delta, or I'm curious?
Well, eventually, yeah, but I did not step on an airplane until I was 25 years old, so... There certainly was no one in the airline industry growing up that I was.
You had never flown on an airplane.
I'd never flown on an airplane. My first trip was a business trip from New York to Chicago. I was 25, as I said, you know, several years already working as a professional at that point. But certainly as I learned more about travel and learned more about aviation, Herb absolutely was someone who was a maverick. He had a way of doing things a little differently, standing out from the crowd. And he had a big heart for people.
So I know you mentioned you worked in finance, had that big five or maybe a six experience at that time. How did you make the decision to join Delta in 1998?
Well, I left the firm. I was a partner there. I left in 92 and went to Pepsi, went down to Frito-Lay, which was a part of PepsiCo, still is to this day, down to Dallas, Texas. And I graduated from a small university in upstate New York, St. Bonaventure, did not have any advanced degrees in business or any other science. And so I thought, and I didn't want to stop my career to go get educated, already had kids at that point. So I thought the best way to get education is to work for a company that produces great leaders and great managers. And PepsiCo called, and I was attracted. And so I left the partnership to go join Pepsi. And it was a time when Roger Enrico and Wayne Calloway and so many great, Chris Sinclair, so many great leaders that were there, so many great colleagues and peers of mine that I still stay in touch with today that run some of the biggest companies in the world. We were all in that pool together, and we learned a lot from each other and went there for about 6 years, learned what I needed to learn, never thought I'd want to spend the rest of my life selling snacks or beverages. And I was traveling a lot, and somebody said, well, geez, you should be on a be working for an airline. It seems like you're on an airline all the time. And I made the mistake of saying, yeah, when Delta called, thinking I already knew the industry, but it's a heck of a lot more complicated to run it than it is to fly in it.
I mean, you were young. How old were you when you joined Delta?
I joined Delta 25 years ago. So I was, to do quick math, I was probably around 40.
Okay. All right. So one of the time things I had was a little wrong. That makes sense. So you joined Delta, I think within 3 years, you were promoted to SVP. And then you were basically called upon to help kind of lead a major part of getting through 9/11 and the ensuing economic downturn. Like, what was that experience like?
Well, Delta, coming to Delta initially was really exciting because I love to travel and I love people and I love experiences. And Delta was on a high. The company was doing quite well. Yeah. It was the dot-com boom era. People were traveling, flying all over the place.
It was go-go, yeah.
It was go-go. And I was happy that I was here. When 9/11 happened, it brought the world to, from our standpoint, really to a stop. I'll never forget because I was on the campus that day and saw the news reports of what happened. And then our first instincts, of course, were make sure all of the Delta crew and Delta people were safe. Fortunately, none of our aircraft were used in that terrorist attack. But we had to put planes down wherever they went, and you know, people up in northern Canada or wherever we needed to drop planes and get people to ground safely, and then figure out how to start the airline back up again. There, whenever you're on our campus, there's in the background, there's always the sound of planes taking off. Hundreds of yards away from the runway here, we're pretty close. And you actually, it's a comforting feeling. There's always that background sound that you get used to until it's not there anymore. And the eeriness, the silence was particularly numbing and scary because we didn't really know where we were going as a company. And fortunately, we were able to start to build our business back, get back on our feet. But what happened at that time was not just international, which was a big moneymaker for us.
Yeah.
Took years for international travel to recover. Took quite a long time for travel in general to recover because TSA and new security protocols, there's just a lot of people that took travel for granted and stopped.
And there was a lot of fear.
There was a lot of fear at the time. So we had to reinvent ourselves. And the thing that people don't understand as well, it wasn't just 9/11, it was also the advent of the internet that also helped bring the big airlines down because for the first time, people could price and buy tickets from alternative channels. To that point in time, airlines were pretty difficult to shop airlines price-wise. Yeah. There weren't the modern tools. You'd have to call a travel agent and try to figure out or call them.
That was the era of the e-savers, too. I remember getting those every Friday.
Yeah. And so the internet, travel was one of the first industries that the internet disintermediated and made shopping and price transparency something that it's great in the long run, but certainly was very painful going through it for the first time.
And look, you came out of that period into being CEO. Were there any, from that downturn, were there any sort of enduring lessons? And we'll talk about COVID a little later, but I'm sure, were there some things from that? I think we tend to learn more sometimes in the downturns and the failures that you were like, all right, I'm going to remember this one.
Yeah, there's no question about it. You learn much more from when things don't go right than when they do. And we went through bankruptcy, in fact, a year prior to that, I was so disenchanted with the decisions that were being taken, a lot of which were really walking away from the company's values. There had been a lot of leadership changes here at Delta during that period, and people were brought in from outside the industry and outside the company. And I don't think they really understood the importance of people and really staying close to the front lines. Delta was a storied airline at that point. We were 75 years already into existence. And in fact, next year we'll be celebrating our 100th anniversary.
Wow.
And
$100 flights?
Well, yeah. Yeah, there'll be lots of hundreds. We'll have some fun with that. But we do have a history here. And I don't know that the leadership team at the time really understood how important it was that it's about the people and it's about the culture. It's not about, you know, who's the smartest guy in the room. And so they brought in a lot of outside industry experts because all the leaders here at the company were homegrown. And you had people at the top that had started on the ramp and worked their way up the chain. And for some reason, as they say, the dawn of the internet and other forces that were brought to bear, they wanted to bring outside experts into leadership positions of the company. And they wound up really not being able to respond to the damage that 9/11 did, and certainly didn't have the relationship or trust with the front lines that were required to go through such a tough time. So I left myself, the company, for a period of time. And I was fortunate that I got called back in to lead the restructuring, to lead the change, and eventually become president of the company.
With everyone fighting for attention these days, how can you get your business to stand out and connect with customers? It's easy. Get Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketing platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. Constant Contact makes it easy to promote your business with powerful tools like email and SMS marketing, social media postings, and even event management. You'll reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and communicate more effectively to sell more, raise more, and fast-track your growth. Constant Contact's writing assistance tools and automation features help you say the right thing at the right time, every time. Plus, you can send with confidence, knowing that your emails are actually reaching your customers, thanks to their best-in-class 97% deliverability rate. Constant Contact was actually the first email marketing platform I ever used almost 20 years ago, and it's a testament to the product's quality that it's still the standard for email marketing today. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact. Helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
So Warren Buffett has been famously quoted as saying there's no joy in being CEO of an airline. I'm sure you would disagree with that. But I think one of the leadership tenets and what he's getting to that I believe most in and I've heard a lot is control what you can control and don't worry about what you can't control. With airlines, however, you have this variable called weather, which is just a critical component of your operations. And to a lesser extent, there is fuel, which is subject to all sort of geopolitical and otherwise. Like, how do you teach and coach your people to protect the company and deal with these, this sort of variable, which you don't control? It's a very unique component of your business.
Yeah, people think that there's much more outside of our control than within our control. And some days it feels that way.
Yeah.
But the fact is that what the weather or fuel prices or geopolitical events, they affect all of us in the industry.
Yeah.
It's not unique to Delta. There's not that Delta walks around with a cloud over its head. So it's really how you compete and how you, the resilience you build and the strength you create to make sure you can create within the industry that resilience that others may not have that same level of capability to respond as quickly or with the same level of agility. We talk a lot about what that means. That means being very, very nimble. It means making sure your financial risks are well understood and well managed. You pay attention to your balance. You don't get ahead of yourself too far. Delta has always had historically the best balance sheet in the industry and one of the best anyway. And COVID hurt it, but we're back there again. And want to be a little cautious about that and make certain that your people stay close to you.
Do you do a lot of disaster or scenario planning? Or as you said, I think that is true. Look, there are some storms that seem to impact airlines in the same cities unequally. So, right, there's clearly a measure of how you've extended yourself or what your response, but is part of the training doing a lot of how do we handle the unknown and the unexpected?
Well, we always spend a lot of time with summer readiness that we start prepping for in January, right? Or winter readiness, which we start prepping in June, with our airport teams and our reservation and service teams. So we're always on in terms of getting ready. And you're right, Robert. It will go through storms and weather and challenges, yet every time you look at it, you turn around, Delta's on top of the operational stack, on top in terms of net promoter score, on top in terms of resilience. It's not that we're organized.
It's not that the clouds don't fall over your airplanes. Yeah.
Yeah. We don't have that kind of success, but the success is making certain that you're prepared and you're investing in the technologies and the tools and being realistic about what you can expect, not putting too much supply out there that exceeds your ability to serve. Air traffic control, everyone knows, is now an issue. And congestion in the skies and aviation infrastructure are issues. There's an untold number of things that are outside our control. I can't control for that. What I can control is our response to that. And you know, we don't spend time modeling just for the sake of modeling. We spend time understanding how do we create more and more resiliency and strength and recovery capability, and that our people know that when tough times happen, that's when customers decide what airline they want to be on. And that's when they see who you are. There was a famous quote that my chairman here at Delta shared with me at the start of the pandemic, is that you know, people think that it's at a crisis that character is formed and found. And the reality is it's not the case, because if you don't have character going into a crisis, it'll be revealed who you are. So crises reveal character. They don't actually build character. And our character was shown during that time, the hardest of times, when everything was out of your control, the way, whether it's blocking the middle seats or you know, the work we did to get through it without furloughing a single employee. There will be case studies written about it for years to come.
Warren Buffett has a similar quote. I think he said, when the tide goes out, you see who's not wearing their bathing suit, right? I think it's a little bit of a synonym for that. In addition to preparation, look, things go wrong. You make mistakes. What is part of your culture in terms of the military has this after action response? How does the team like culturally train to kind of learn from mistakes, which are inevitable?
You learn, as I said earlier, you learn a lot more from mistakes than when everything goes well. And we're always doing after action reports on every incident, every thunderstorm, every opportunity that we've had where we had to make decisions and put judgment in play to make sure we're learning from it. What could we have done differently now that you actually understand what actually happened? One of the things I learned at Pepsi, I talk about my career, and one of the reasons I went to Pepsi was to learn how to be a better decision maker. People have this sense that only smart people make good decisions, or really experienced people make good decisions, or you know, there's this, how do you become a good decision maker? And yeah, it takes experience, it takes talent, it takes hard work. But I think primarily you actually have to have the courage to make decisions, and you make them quickly. The one thing I learned is that when you're faced with a decision, the sooner you make the decision rather than waiting to make that decision, the easier the decision is, because it's a smaller decision. And decisions that aren't taken are decisions in themselves. And if they can be balled up into a bigger decision. And so learning to respond quickly and learning to recover quickly and course correcting quickly and not get stuck on that decision enhances your batting average to be a better decision maker. And that's true whether you're an airline executive or candidly any other manager running a business. I really do believe the sooner you get comfortable making decisions, the better leader you'll be.
Yeah, the one crisis that your industry wasn't tied into, which was the banking crisis last year. I wrote about this. I remember seeing there were a lot of organizations and places where I had investments that were tied up in SVB or First Republic otherwise. And some got out emails over the weekend about what they were doing and the status. And I think others were just sitting there holding their thumbs, and had the Fed not bailed them out on Monday, they would have been in trouble. And it just, again, I think sometimes people give too much credence to the actual decision as an inflection point, where like it's a fundamentally right or wrong, versus you could have executed on either path and made it a good outcome.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The fact that you're out there and you're moving forward and you're not studying, you're not paralyzed, gives you the ability to recover.
I have a personal analogy. It may not be the right choice, but it actually with airlines, or any time I get stuck or reroute or have a problem, I always get on the flight that moves me more towards where I want to go than stay there. I just feel like I'm doing something. It might not be the right choice in a lot of cases, but it's funny. If I'm offered the choice to wait or sort of keep going, I try to keep going.
So do you look back and do you kind of look at what that flight you were on and ask yourself, did you get there sooner or not?
Of course I do.
And so what's your batting average?
I think I feel better. in motion. So even if it's not the right choice, I think waiting and feeling helpless, like I don't like that feeling. I like being in motion.
Getting out of harm's way is always a good decision.
Right. So look, air travel is a challenging line of work from a customer service standpoint. As someone who's traveled extensively for 25 years myself, like I often feel like many people on the front lines of airline customer service don't want to be there. So full disclosure, I'm a Diamond Medallion on Delta. I try to fly Delta exclusively. I've seen and felt the difference. Delta has been ranked number one in customer service by numerous publications, Business Travel, Wall Street Journal, J.D. Power. What's the difference? I remember Southwest used to hire people that were funny and train them to be flight attendants. The opposite wouldn't work. Is it the people you hire? Is it the culture? Is it a combination? Like, there's definitely a difference. I'd love to understand a little bit of the secret formula.
Yeah. Well, it's a little bit of all you mentioned. We spend a lot of time on culture here. And people look at culture, and a lot of people think about that's an outcome as compared to something you can actually go and form and create for yourself and actually continue to evolve and morph. I look at culture, I define culture as really the where your values, your framework of your purpose comes right into play in terms of defines who you are. And so culture to us is living and breathing, and it's every single day where you're either putting deposits in the bank or someone's taking something out of the bank, and you want to continue to be putting investments in your culture bank. I'll give you a quick illustration. This morning, I was speaking at a large group company gathering we call Velvet with 600 frontline employees from all over the world that we gather from all different functions and whatnot. And we do these. This year, we'll do 15 different sessions of these for a day and a half apiece on all different places. And we bring all different people together that we continue and give all of our frontline people the opportunity to interact with all of our leaders, not just me. I lead each one of these. And many of the leaders will talk about the different parts of the business. We'll celebrate success. We'll talk about what we've learned. They'll ask us questions. We'll engage. I'll have a selfie line a mile long. Whatever it is, it's fun and it's joy. And people are there and they consistently, and it's an internal company gathering. Could you imagine this? And we ask them to rate it at the end on a scale of 1 to 5 in terms of, so that we learn how we're doing. Consistently, they rate the overall experience as 4.8 to 4.9. I mean, that out of 600 people for an internal event, I mean, it's unheard of. But we've been doing it for 18 years. And we've built such a loyal gathering from within. We've got brought in many new hires. A third of the company's new within the last several years. Wow. Those people all come to those sessions because they want to learn. They want to be seen. They want to develop. They
I heard it's a 4.8. They want to know what's going on.
Exactly. And you would think we're handing out money, which we're not. But the opportunity to participate as part of that culture is what we create. It's teamwork. And at Delta, I talk about our company as a team of teams. We have 5,000 flights a day. Every flight that goes off, there's a team that's making that happen. And so it truly is a team of teams and collaboration. And it's the ultimate team sport is this industry. And so when you have that, it very much is about pouring into people and pouring into success and culture and helping people through and reaching across the various lines of the company to feel like we're all on the same team. And that starts at the top. And I lead each one of those sessions that I have for 18 years. Wow. And I'll religiously make sure that this year we'll do 15 of them religiously. I'll make certain I'm at each one of these. And the people, you know, come there to make certain. And it's not just a rah-rah gathering. We'll talk about the tough stuff. We'll talk about the things that aren't going right. We'll talk about the things that we expect of each other to do better at. And that's where culture is not just formed, it's actually invested in. And so when they go out to the field, they can share that with their teammates. They can share that with their customers, what they learned. And that just spreads through wildfire. And you continue to build on that. So that's just one. There's many, many other examples, but that's just one way in which we do it differently.
So I also read that you really have empowered the frontline employees to solve problems. I think, again, having been across numerous airlines, there's when you see people yelling and arguing in counters, there's a lot of, that's our policy. I can't do anything about it. So I could assume it's hard to be happy with your work when you have no control over the outcome and you feel like I just have to follow the systems. How much do you think your level of empowerment is different and unique?
Well, we want our people never to have to use that as the reason for being.
I can't tell you how many times I've heard those phrases at airline.
No, I can appreciate that. But we want our people to understand why. And that's one of the ways in which we do the why. You know, we want our people to be caring. We want our people to be empathetic. We want our people to be welcoming and realize that we can't solve all issues, that we just need to be able to do the best we can as we're moving forward. And those are three attributes of our brand: welcoming, caring, and elevated. The experience that we want our people to model, whether you're on board a flight as a pilot, whether you're in maintenance, you know, getting that, make sure that plane's ready to go on time, whether you're on a call with reservations, whether you're a baggage handler. Those are the themes across which we want our people to continue to emulate. And we spend time explaining to them and talking to them and recognizing when we see it and calling it out and building that as the themes to success. There's no easy answer there, Robert. It's just the fact that we're consistent and we do it year in and year out. And when we're investing in the technologies and the tools to put them in a position to win, it's not just playing defense, which you're describing.
Yeah.
A lot of it's playing offense. We have the best reliability because we have the best engineering talent. We have the best maintenance practice. We have the best part allocations. We have kind of a mindset in our operations control center, knowing what we're good at, what we can do, what we can't do, where to flex and where to pull back. And every single day we're at it and we communicate well across the company. It's a company that not just with your customers, but you communicate with your teams all around the world constantly what's happening to make certain those deliverables and ensuring everyone's on the same page.
So running a global airline that's, I assume that there is a plane somewhere in the world every minute of the day that's flying nonstop, obviously headquartered in Atlanta, with such a kind of crazy, complex organization. How do you spend your time? How much is on the front lines? I assume, and God, you have multiple front lines. So what does that look like for you in terms of being in the office or being in the field?
I always prefer to be in the field. I travel a lot. I travel to see our people where they are. This is not a job where you can walk around and see people. You know, our people travel themselves.
Yeah.
They're on planes, they're in airports, they're in maintenance bays. I probably spend 50% of my time on the road with our people or in large employee gatherings. That's my own internal goal. And when I think about time allocation, I speak a lot. I get opportunities such as this to tell the Delta story. And I'm visible. I'm going to be heading out to Vegas later today. I'm speaking at a large tech conference tomorrow. It's putting our brand in places that people haven't seen it before. We made our debut on the stage of South by Southwest just a few weeks ago. And
Nice. The
big splash there will show up at the CES in Vegas regularly. We want to be seen as a brand that's on the move. And so to be out there, and you know, we're right or wrong, I wound up becoming the face of the brand to a lot of people because I'm on the silly little video on the front of the screen welcoming everybody on board. You have to be out there continuing to promote and continuing to support.
So when you fly, you're not undercover boss.
It's impossible. They kind of know who I am. The customers know who I am. Many times you'll find me in back. It won't just be in front. I'll get customer. I spent a lot of my flights working the flight, and I'll start in the cockpit and work my way back. And I enjoy it. As I say, if I didn't like people, I'm in the wrong job. I actually do enjoy people.
Do you work the on the ground? Like, do you work baggage? Do you work in all kind of aspects of it?
I used to.
Yeah.
Early days. Now I...
They don't want you lifting bags.
I don't need to be doing that, but I'll spend time on the ramp and I'll spend time out with our people where they are in their workspaces. Yeah.
So as we kind of talked about earlier, running an airline, you get very good at crisis management. COVID was an existential threat to the airline industry. I think I read Delta lost, actually, the stat was incredible. I didn't think it was that bad. 95% of the revenue in 30 days. Talk about your approach to this COVID crisis, particularly also the role that trust and sort of that trust and culture bank played. And I think probably also some of the lessons you had learned from the 9/11 experience.
Yeah. Well, COVID was the granddaddy of it all. You know, you kind of put 9/11 and bankruptcy and global financial crisis and everything possible into one bucket, and you amplify it five times. That's what the pandemic meant to us. Yeah, we lost 95% of our revenue in the first 30 days, and it was worse than that because we had a lot of people looking for refunds for tickets that they had paid for travel they no longer wanted to take, obviously.
Yeah.
So the first 90 days of COVID, we had $100 million going out the door every day net. We're losing $100 million a day in cash.
And that's without the planes flying.
That's
just operational.
That's just all in.
Yeah.
That's refunds out. That's lack of revenue in. We kept the planes flying. We didn't fly as many, and we certainly didn't fly internationally. So we lost $10 billion in the first 90 days of cash. Wow. And so it was monumental. And it took us probably a decade to get our balance sheet in the position.
That's why you have a rainy day fund, right? No one ever thinks it's going to rain.
And then 90 days later, it was all gone again. It was pretty devastating. But again, we weren't singled out. The world was needing to work together to understand what was happening. Airlines were a place where people paid a lot of attention to. We were very visible during that period. We actually spent, and I, as well as other members of my industry, we spent a lot of time, you know, in D.C. in the first couple months. We put together the very first CARES Act, where the White House particularly was very, and made some important decisions to protect the jobs of airline workers. And they gave us money that if we took the money, we were committed to keeping people on the payroll, which we did. But in turn, we had to fly all through COVID in the U.S. We weren't allowed to cancel a single route that we operated pre-COVID. Because this country is so large, people needed to stay connected. Families needed to get together. People needed to get to the front lines.
And that's your mission, right? Connecting.
That's our mission. And, you know, people weren't traveling back then that wanted to travel. People were traveling because they had to travel. And it was hard. And our people kept those airways open when others were told, everyone else was told to stay home. So against that backdrop, I spent the first couple of weeks pretty disillusioned, as you could imagine, wondering, you know, what in the world is happening? But then realized it was the most important time to lead than ever, at least in our history. And I don't know why I was in the seat I was when the crisis hit, but I was going to make certain I viewed it as a privilege, not a burden, to lead. And it wasn't something that I was tasked with. It was something I had an opportunity to do, and just took a positive attitude every single day. And I'd have to give myself that pep talk maybe several times a day, because you're making hard decisions and you're kind of putting, it was very much truly one step forward and three steps back some days, where you were constantly focusing on what you could do to make it better and to keep everyone with you along the way. Very transparent. We communicated a lot. We used a lot of video tools like this internally as well as externally. Showed a lot of vulnerability. Our people were able to see me virtually every day in terms of just my body language. I was in the office every day, and you know, no one else was. You know, our leadership team was, but hardly anyone else was. And to make certain that they knew I was okay, they were following the story and the saga. And I talk about what I think's happening, what we're thinking of doing, where we're trying to go next. And every day, and people were just, and thousands of people would watch every single day. And so that you were communicating and you were walking an entire company through the recovery and what we are learning from DC and what we are learning from the medical profession and what we're seeing in the business. And so by the time that people actually started to travel again, our people were ready to go. We had 50% of our people volunteer to take time off without pay. We're a big, big company, 100,000 employees. One of the biggest obstacles that cut into that $100 million burn a day was to figure out ways to get smaller quickly. And you can either furlough or you can work differently with your employees. We chose to work differently. I asked them to take time off without pay. We had 50,000 people take up to 2 years without pay. We kept their benefits intact. They gave them an opportunity to travel if they wanted. And we shrunk the company in half, literally overnight. And then we had early retirement offers for another 20,000. So we actually got down to a company shape of about 30,000 in 6 months, which is unheard of in a heavy fixed cost industry. And that saved us a lot of money. It allowed us to keep those middle seats on planes blocked through the course of the entire pandemic. And oftentimes when you do the right thing, it's also the smart thing, because by blocking those middle seats for as long as we did, and that was our reputation as the airline that was taking the best care of its own people and its customers through the crisis, we actually generated more revenue by not selling the seats than the carriers that decided to sell their seats.
Because people were more likely to fly because the seats were not full and they had the space?
Our brand was strong going in, and we somehow became known as the brand to fly during COVID if you were going to fly. Because most people, as I said, were not flying because they wanted to fly. A lot of people were flying because they had to fly.
Yeah.
We blocked first class cabin. You know, it was every first class seat had a seat next to it empty.
Yeah, interesting.
And others didn't do that, and we did.
So you had more seats by restricting capacity. That's fascinating.
Yeah, so it was pricing. People were paying more to be on Delta than they would pay to be on any other airline that was selling. The reason I did it, Robert, was not solely for the customer value, which was great, and customers still stop me to this day and thank me for doing that. It was for our own employees, because the employees didn't want to work a crowded flight any more than customers wanted to sit on a crowded flight or in a crowded airport. So when you say you put people first and it's your culture, those words are really easy to say, but it's the actions that people look to that matter. Not furloughing anyone, only airline didn't furlough anybody. Blocking the middle seats throughout the crisis, only airline that did it, and generating the most revenue from it as a result of that, that's putting people first.
You also convince customers to take credit and not cash, right?
Yeah. We had such loyalty. And our reservation agents were heroes. They would listen to people's sob stories and the challenges that they were facing, and our customers would cry on the phone with our agents. And you know, we were all in this together. It wasn't that about Delta. Yeah. It was about the world. And we had billions of dollars of in terms of customer deposits that we were holding. And the majority of those customers agreed to hold to keep the money with Delta. Yeah. They could have had it they wanted, but yeah. the majority of them decided to hold on to it. And they said, I want to know that I'm with you through this. And it was a kind of a small token at the time of what they could do.
But yeah, look, as you said, you need to save money for a rainy day. You need to build trust for when you need it. I think one thing people might have missed in this is that I think in February 2020, you just paid a record $1.6 billion profit share to employees. You also unveiled an airplane that had the names of all 90,000 employees on it. I have to think that timing of that goodwill helped you a lot.
Yeah. And in fact, I used it when I went out in March of 2020, and I just didn't know because I told them that was my vision, that to get through this, not furloughing anyone. And I told them I thought it was a crazy idea and didn't know that I could actually do it, but that was going to be our goal. And we did it, which was marking. But I told them that we just had distributed $1.6 billion. So I knew we had made a major deposit into the bank. And we also knew that people wanted a break. They wanted to get away from travel and figure out. So we kept their benefits intact and people just responded. And I was just so proud of them.
I was curious to ask you. So I'm sort of an airplane junkie. And one of the things I knew about Delta and noticed years ago that you had this strategy where you were buying a lot of older jets or the AirTran jets or otherwise, and you were gutting the inside and making them entirely new because to the customers, those looked like new planes. It seems like you've pivoted in the last couple of years and now are buying brand new jets and bigger jets and long range jets. I have a couple questions about it. Why the strategy change? And then talking about, like, in general, can you share about when, how do you know when it's time to change strategy? I think sometimes a strategy works and then people overdo it past its prime. And I'm guessing something in the market changed that made you pivot on that. Or maybe it's an and. I'd love to hear the background on that.
I think it's an and.
Yeah.
If fleet is foundational to us, then those fleet decisions that we take when we buy a new airplane, we expect it to be around 25, 30 years or more.
Yeah.
And we were opportunistic. We have an incredible maintenance team and their ability to actually take a used aircraft and reinvest in it and bring more life to it and put the Delta shine and brand on was amazing. And we did it. As you mentioned, when Southwest bought AirTran, the 717s didn't fit with Southwest fleet. And we knew at some point Southwest was going to be willing to have a conversation, which they did. And we took almost 100 717s from Southwest. And not only did we take the planes, of course, you take them with customers and routes attached to them as well. So it was really one of the, I think, looking back, one of the big pivots that we made, being opportunistic, having capability, but having the courage to move in that direction. I don't know a lot of companies that would have been as bold to take on something like that. And what it did, it not only allowed us to grow Atlanta even faster with a lot of those planes than in Delta Colors, it allowed us to get out of the smaller planes, the 50-seater planes, the 717s, 100-seater plane. And so we vacated the planes that people hated, the small little regional jets, which at the time was our largest fleet. And we upgauged the airline to a larger mainline cabin that had a lot more utility, a lot more customer amenity attached to it. That was one of the best plays I think we ever made. We still did it. By the way, we did during the pandemic. We took some Airbus 350s from LATAM, and we're in the process of converting them to Delta currently. Lion Air, we took a bunch of 737-900s, and we did the same thing. But long-term, when you're bringing other people's fleet into your fleet plan, and remember, we've got 1,000 planes, so it's a pretty big undertaking. It creates also a lot of inefficiencies, and it creates a lot of incremental work, and it creates additional steps in the process. And there's a value. One of the best things that Southwest and Herb Kelleher did over time was use simplicity as his model to create value. We oftentimes in our business use complexity to create value and seek to get paid for it. There's a middle ground there. You want to make sure you're driving where you're good at and getting value from it. But you know, 1,000 plane fleet, you've got to have a lot of different models. And the more in which you can align those, because you have different pilots are trained on different aircraft models and different maintenance practices and different part ratios. And if you're going to be the most reliable airline in the world, it's really hard to be the most reliable and the most complicated.
Those things don't go hand in hand. So again, all kinds of things come up. I'm curious to ask you, another recent challenge earlier this year was you made some large changes to the Delta SkyMiles program. Particularly, I'd say the point enthusiast community had a pretty big backlash around the changes. And it actually prompted the company to walk back some of those changes and change the changes. Just from a leadership standpoint, I'd love for you to share kind of like, what was the process of making those changes, kind of listening to the response and then deciding to say, hey, we didn't get it right in some of these areas. And I think also like what was missing in the first rollout where that kind of created that disconnect?
Anytime you touch loyalty, you're going to get backlash, right?
Yeah. So people don't like change.
People don't like change. And even if it's changed for good, the people that are benefited are not the ones that will speak out. It's the ones that are being.
Right. And my other experience is people only focus on what you take away, not what they gain. That's been my other learning in leadership. Yeah.
And that is fair. You know, we had a problem here. We had a lot of success. We have a lot of loyal customers. We have a lot of high value customers. We have a lot of premium customers, and we've accumulated a lot. Through COVID, we were by far the most generous of extending loyalty and keeping status all through the entire COVID. It wasn't until this year that finally all those COVID extensions started to burn off. And so not only did we keep our medallion, upper end medallion population intact, we grew it with new people that were starting to come to the airline and fly it during that period of time. So we had more premium customers and more premium demand than we actually had assets. And on top of that, you look at the popularity of the credit card and American clubs, Express and the benefits that that creates, put a lot of pressure on our people, on the assets, and actually started to take your premium assets, whether it's your clubs or your reservation lines or even the ability to get the upgrades, and dilute the quality of the experience for many. So we knew we had to make change. And I don't think anyone really disagreed with that. They all wanted us to do it maybe in a little different way that would have maybe harmed the other guy, but didn't harm them.
It benefited them.
And they wanted to be the line where the line gets drawn. They wanted to be above the line, and they were okay. Everyone else falling below the line. So I got a lot of feedback along the way. Still to this day, I get a lot of feedback on that. But I knew that this was going to be painful going through it. And our team did a lot of work, spent a lot of time. This wasn't a willy-nilly, this wasn't kind of a brainchild that came in from left field trying to figure out. But it's really hard to get a great customer view or sample. You know, if we take these things away, how are you going to respond? You know, we knew what the answer was going to be. But I think the thing that we saw was it came back with a lot more fury and a lot more angst than our team anticipated that we were going to have. So I was watching it carefully. I was involved in the decisions up front. Our team knew that I was a little wary of what we were doing. They had convinced me that no matter what we did, there was going to be backlash. So,
which is true, yeah.
Why don't we kind of go right to where we thought we needed to go and then do our best to endure it? And when we did that, it was way too much. And it was too much change in too short a period of time, which was really the mistake in that model. So you need to walk people through things over time. And especially if you touch anything like loyalty, which is their relationship, what they've earned. After all, our program's called Sky Miles. It's not called Sky Dollars. Yeah. And then you're now taking miles and time in planes and devaluing that whole element of earning power. I knew it was going to be tough. When I saw that and I heard a lot from customers, I'm very accessible. Everyone knows how to reach me through my email or other means. And I read a lot of those letters. And people took time to write really long letters that were heartfelt. I mean, it was like a breakup letter. It was like, I love you. I love your people. I love what you do. But, you know, you hurt me beyond repair. And I don't know that I can stay in this relationship with you anymore. It was the theme of a lot of them. And there were some very serious ones in there.
I guess, as you said, this is loyalty, right?
This is loyalty. Yeah, you're breaking the deal. And one of our tenets here at Delta is we keep our deals. We take good care of people, customers included. So I was ready to call a timeout quickly, and I did. You know, within the first 10 days of the announcement, I was scheduled to speak at the Atlanta Rotary. It's kind of a funny story in hindsight. And when the announcement came out about the loyalty changes, I was out of the country on business. And when I came back and I was already seeing overseas what the feedback was, I looked at my calendar and I'm speaking at the Atlanta Rotary, which was right the center of all of our high value customers. And I'd have hundreds of them right there. And I said, boy, this was really a smart thing to put on our calendar, wasn't it? Maybe I shouldn't go do that one, have someone else And our team said, no, this is the right time for you to go and just take the heat and just talk to them about what's happening. And I told them they're right. And I went there and I spoke about it. I explained a little bit of what we were trying to do, but also I acknowledged that we went too far. We were going to pull up and make some adjustments to it. And we did. And we made some meaningful adjustments a couple of weeks later, actually implemented a few new things, a few new benefits that hadn't even been in the previous program for truly the long live members that we have, you know, making them 360s or diamonds for life at lower levels.
Yeah.
And the feedback I received consistently after that was thank you. You didn't necessarily get to where I was hoping you'd get to, but at least you made a valiant attempt, and I understand why you had to make change. And we, in a very interesting way, Robert, ended up in a better spot because of the turmoil that we went through. That wasn't the plan. Than if we just kind of laid out even that where we're at now as the initial plan of attack.
Right. And there's data around that. I think what you said is key, though, from a leadership standpoint. And I watched, I said, look, we got some of this wrong. We don't have the answer yet, but give us a few weeks and we're going to work it out rather than rushing another solution. It sounds like you took some feedback and made that. And Rivian had a similar thing. And I think a lot of companies who've had a problem and then resolved it have actually endeared more loyalty than had they never had the problem.
That's exactly right. And by the way, a lot of that feedback went into the formation of how we adjusted the plan and some of the changes that we made.
Yeah. I watched interest. I benefited. I was one of those people who had a lot of rollover. And so I think the extension of that was super helpful. Yeah, look, we don't all get it right the first time, but I think doubling down on too often people double down on mistakes. And I think, again, the learning there from what I saw was, hey, cooling off period. We're taking the feedback. Give us a little time and we'll try to get it right.
We've done a lot of great things here. We've done a lot of right things. We've been pretty successful for a pretty long period of time here. And it's easy to lose your humility. In that, it's easy for people to think that you kind of come across as a bit cocky or arrogant or complacent or taking it for granted. We're not. I mean, the one thing about our brand that I love is our tagline is keep climbing. Humility is really important in leadership. I think a lot of people don't recognize that. Yeah, you need to be aggressive. You need to be courageous. You need to be bold, but you also need to be humble and you need to listen. And that combination, when you can find great leaders who are both humble but still hungry, still courageous, that's where greatness.
Well, Ed, your career has had a lot of stories, a lot of chapters. Do you think you're going to write a book based on all your experiences?
I get asked that question a lot.
I can think of a whole bunch of titles.
I've got a lot. I've got chapters yet to write before I'm done, but yeah, we'll see. Stay tuned.
Ed, thank you for joining us today and sharing your story with our listeners. And congrats again on being named CEO of the Year. I think hopefully our listeners got a good sense of why you won that award and can learn some valuable lessons.
Robert, I appreciate your loyalty to Delta and the business that you provide us. And as many of your listeners, I'm sure, are loyal Delta customers, I want to thank them all for their loyalty to Delta. And we're here every day trying to make your experience that much better.
All right, to our listeners, thank you for tuning in to the Elevate podcast today. We'll include links to Ed and his work on the detailed episode page at robertglaser.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, please make sure to follow the show to be notified about new episodes and have them downloaded automatically to listen in your podcast app. You can hit follow on Apple, CastBox, Spotify, or Pandora, or your favorite podcast player to get all the new episodes. Thanks again for your support. Until next time, keep elevating.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap, Young and Profiting Podcast, a number one entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's number one negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the podcast princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting Podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting Podcast, or YAP, like it's often called by my YAP fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.